Hey, this is Christian Bush from Sugarland, and you are listening to Sound Sessions. There you go, making my heart beat
again, heartbeat again. Hey everyone, this is your host Mike Heidemann, one of the most popular duos of all time. The group Sugarland has sold nearly 10 million albums domestically, earned 7 number one singles, and kicked ass all over this country of ours. Now, with the release of their first new album in 8 years, Bigger, Jennifer Nettles and Christian Bush are about to embark on a multi-city tour. We welcome Christian to Sound Sessions. What's going on, man?
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. So where are you calling from now?
I'm calling from currently in Nashville, Tennessee. About to get on a bus or a plane and go to Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh, love Omaha. Are you ready for the tour?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a pretty fantastic thing getting to put these songs back on stages and watch fans' faces kind of, break into the joy of, oh, my gosh, I haven't heard this in so long. And and our faces have the same look on them because we haven't played them in so long.
I could imagine. So I was going to ask, because you're such a talented producer, singer, songwriter, guitar player, how do you create that signature sound for Sugarland when you're putting out these records? How do you create that vibe?
You know, I think it's kind of dictated by the way we write songs together. You know, it's a unique mix. Whenever you put two creative people together, they're like chemicals. Mm-hmm. And they have each chemical pairing has a unique reaction, you know? And Jennifer and I seem to somehow squish together, you know, the melodies and the chord progressions and things like this that are uniquely Sugarland. And then it has like the messaging that goes into the songs. And then Jennifer's amazing voice and kind of my obsessiveness with trying to make songs both feel like they're on the radio and also try to carry as much art as they can carry. I think that's the gumbo that makes it work.
Yeah, I feel you on that, because it's really interesting, because you played music your whole life, and now instead of playing to a crowd of maybe 13 people at a local bar or honky-tonk, you're playing in front of thousands of people. Does that kind of seep into your mind when you're writing your music, that this might be tattooed on somebody's arm one day?
Funny that you say that. There's a really cool culture in the Sugarland fan world of tattooing a lot of the words, mm-hmm. you know, that we write. And even as much as they, you know, they're like, would you please write this down so that I can have your handwriting?
Wow.
And, you know, at first I was like, wow, that's super cool. And then it got a little weird for me. And I was like, you know what? It's not weird. It's not weird at all. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these songs and these messages, music has saved my life many times. Mm-hmm. So I love it that people find things that resonate with them, and then they want to tell that story on their body. That's totally fine with me. But yes, communicating with large numbers of people that you're not going to really be able to meet them all is a responsibility, you know. And once you start getting used to it, it gets easier.
Yeah, it's artistry on its highest level.
It's pretty humbling, you know, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to dive back a little bit into your background, because I love hearing all the interviews and seeing you speak on TV and watching you at, you know, the CMA Awards. I'm a musician myself, and I've been playing here in Chicago for a short time now. I go to a lot of open mics here in the city. I'm very lucky to be living in a musical city like Chicago. Looking back on your career, what was it? What was that fire in yourself that caused you to go to all these open mics in Georgia and just play every night, going late nights and just writing? What was that push that you had that made you want to be an artist to the level you're at now?
I that's a good question. I think that originally it was the fascination that the song itself, because the song happens before the artist does, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No one ever says, oh my God, that's my favorite singer at an open mic night. Mm-hmm. They say, oh my God, that's my favorite song.
Yeah.
You know? And it gave me a glimpse into the world of how, if you go back to the same place where there's an audience, no matter how small, and you watched their face when you played your last song, and you decided you could tell who was being entertained and why, and what part of that song was entertaining. You can go back and you can make a new one that maybe has that same attitude or that same turn or that same thing, and you can improve it. And it's like, I joke all the time with new artists. I'm like, look, we just got to get in the studio and start failing.
Yeah.
And they're looking at me like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you need to fail as fast as possible so that you can correct the things that are failing and start to succeed. And success in the music business isn't about the business. It's about the music part of that.
Mm-hmm.
That when the music starts to succeed, then the business sort of chases you down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what it taught me. And the fire and the drive was that I had an audience that would at least respond to the music. And, you know, if you don't have a song on the radio, you don't have a direct connection to sitting next to one of your friends and say, I'm going to play you a song, right? Mm-hmm. You get no feedback. So that's what those open mics were. And that's what the culture of making more stuff is. And when you can find that wherever you are in the world, take it and go do it and repeat it and repeat it so that you can constantly start to innovate what you're doing.
It's so true. Do you ever go back and play any of those spots in Georgia? I saw you just on stage wearing the Atlanta, Georgia shirt, so playing Georgia on my mind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was just there. That was here at the Ryman in Nashville last night. But, yeah, I do go back. I play Eddie's Attic a good bit. And once a year I play around Thanksgiving, the Sunday after Thanksgiving. And I try to go back and make sure that these new songs that I'm writing, when I'll play them for an audience that has been there for me for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll tell you if they like one of them, and they'll go to the restroom while they don't.
It's very true. It's very true. That's the pain you have to deal with as a musician, and especially as an open micer, man. There's no tougher crowd than just sitting there and seeing people stare at you with blank faces, I'm sure.
Right. Yes.
Do you remember the first song you learned to play on your guitar?
I do. I learned the Roy Orbison, Girl, You Really Got Me.
Oh, yes. Huge Roy Orbison fan.
So I remember that. I remember trying to make an A chord and, you know, like pulling the E string down when it's a G. I was like, huh, that's how that works. And I was a pretty quick study on the guitar just because I was a violinist and I had been trained by ear. So if I could get my fingers to do the things that made the sounds the way I heard them on the radio, then suddenly I could get some work done.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Because you're trying to emulating the sounds that you hear off the radio was the way that I started playing guitar too. It's just seeing Eric Clapton play, or even Roy Orbison, just seeing the way he looked. It's just, I wanted that. When you were young and you were growing up, what was that first record that your mom or dad put on the record player that you thought, wow, this is something different. This is what I need to do with my life.
Hmm. I don't know if it was them that did that for me, but I remember trying to understand the Police Synchronicity record. And then I saw that tour the same year. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, that's what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to deconstruct it. I would learn each part, you know, and it was a pretty intricate three piece, that band. And, but it was all based on rhythms, you know, and the bass playing was rhythmic. The guitar playing was rhythmic. Obviously the drummer was great. And it kind of taught me how to interpret what the radio is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And funny enough, when I got my first big record deal, I ended up in London with the producer who produced that record.
Wow.
He produced my first record. So it was pretty amazing.
That's wild. You know, it's so funny because it's great to hear how instrumental you are and how fully formed you are as a musician. Do you believe in kismet things? Do you believe in the universe, like, telling you and pushing you in a certain direction? Because the fact that that was your first tour that you saw, and then he became your producer, I mean, that's pretty full circle, my friend.
Well, and I could ask a question at 22 years old that was completely informed. I was like, hey, I have a question for you. He's like, yeah, sure. And I'm like, on this particular song at this particular moment, when this sound happens, what is that? And he looked at me like sideways, and he was like, well, and he gave me the answer. And I was like, awesome. Because most of this journey of discovering how to be a recording artist, because that's kind of what I write down when somebody has like a sheet to fill out and they ask you your occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm somewhat confused as to what to put there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in the past 10 years, I've gotten very comfortable with writing recording artist or professional recording artist, because that's exactly what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I make things, I record them, and then I go out on the road and I support the things that I recorded. Mm-hmm. Because of the way I learned it. But yeah, I believe in kismet. I believe that your brain and your heart and your mind connect in a way to dream stuff up, and you're like, oh, I'm just dreaming right now. But and I think there's an unconscious focus that can happen, and you know, I'm sure there's a way to train it. I'm sure there's some guru somewhere, but I am the living testimony that you know, thoughts become things.
Mm-hmm.
Choose the good ones. You don't want the bad ones.
Oh, man. You know, when you come to Chicago one of these days, I would love to get you in studio. It'd be great to meet you and sit down and talk with you a little bit longer.
Oh, thank you so much, my friend. Thank you.
Of course. That is Christian Bush from the band Sugarland. He's playing August 23rd at Highland Park here in Chicago, Illinois, at the Ravinia Festival. We are so stoked to see you. Before I let you go, you can check out his podcast, too, Geeking Out. I had a million Geeking Out questions for you, but I'll save those for next time.
Okay, sounds great.
What's your favorite memory of Chicago? Leave us on that.
Actually, I shot my first sort of lyric video to my song Trailer Hitch there, and it ended up being a strange little social experiment where I was trying to, I put a guitar case out and then my guitar out, and I started playing songs, and I was trying to give away money that was in the case to people that were walking by rather than asking people to put money in it.
Okay.
And I'll never forget having to convince people to do that. And then at a certain point, the people of Chicago, passerby, started to realize what was going on. And I started to ask them if they would help. And they were more apt to take money and give it to someone else than they were to just take it from me.
Wow. What part of Chicago were you in?
I thought, well, that's a really amazing thing for people walking down the street.
Mm-hmm. That's so great. That's so great. We are excited to see you when you get back August 23rd. Thank you again for joining us here on Sound Sessions, Christian.
Thanks, man.
Can't get enough of Sound Sessions? Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter @SoundSeshPod, and check us out on Instagram.